Welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Jörg Wuttke. Jörg is a China expert and has lived in the country for 30 years. In May, he was elected for a third time as the president of the European Union Chamber of Commerce in China, a highly respected business association that is an excellent source for analysis about trade and commercial policy in China. We're going to talk about the Chinese economy and the current trade war between China and the United States, how that is affecting European businesses and Europe's attempt to address its concern over trade and market access policy in China. Jörg, welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. I want us to start this conversation with a stock take of the trade war between China and the United States. At the recent G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, the two sides agreed to a standstill in this trade war. But that standstill comes after a series of tariff hikes and failed attempts to conclude an agreement that would resolve at least some of the frictions that exist between them. It is obvious that the tariff war now is beginning to bite, that it's damaging the economy in China as well as the United States. So from your perch in Beijing, Jörg, what would you say is the realistic scenario for these negotiations going forward? Will they conclude successfully with tariffs going away? Or do you rather think that we're looking towards a long period of continued friction, perhaps with the prospect of the trade war ramping up?
Well, we've come a long way from Xi Jinping's visit in Florida, Mar-a-Lago, where he was meeting Trump and went away and said there are 1,000 reasons to get along with the U.S. and not a single reason to fall out with the U.S. And now we have a full-fledged technology and trade war. So sometimes, of course, here in the Beijing elite circles, they ask themselves, so how come that our president could misjudge the situation so badly? How come that our diplomats didn't pick it up what actually Trump, Navarro, and the others had in mind? So it's a situation where the government here is puzzled about what Washington wants. They recognize the flip-flop character of the president. They realize that whatever they give actually might not be valid shortly after. So it is totally against whatever the Chinese like in negotiation styles. And that makes it, of course, very difficult to come up with compromises and solutions. I guess Osaka was a success in as far as we have stopped the downfall, and they have stopped the way in which these two nations battled it out on tariffs and technology gains. But at the same time, it has changed the atmosphere. I mean, it's not just that you can get it back on track with a couple of LNG and soya deals and a narrowing or lowering the kind of market access problems that we have over here. It turned into a trust thing, and that's driven by this technology war, you could say, that has unfolded. China has realized that the U.S. wants to contain China technology-wise, and even if the U.S. let Huawei operate in the market and stops lobbying its allies to get rid of Huawei, then still the awareness is we, China, have to do everything ourselves here in China. And this will be irreversible. This is a clear-cut outcome. And, of course, that means in many, many ways decoupling.
You said that it had stiffened the lip of the Chinese government. I want to follow up with a question sort of was on China's resolve here, because on the one hand, any government, and especially a government like China's, would have reacted very badly to sort of the confrontational attitude that we've seen from the White House and from the U.S. administration when it comes to this trade war. On the other hand, we're also seeing that the economic consequences of this trade war is now becoming real for China, that if it continues, it's going to lower its economic prospects for the future, and it may have consequences that are much bigger than those that we can now predict, because, as you say, what basically lies ahead is probably a deepening conflict, if not deepening frictions, around technology and China's ability to basically compete, not just in China, but in other markets in the world with its technological goods and technological services. So I want to hear about China's resolve. You said that the administration or sort of Beijing is puzzled and that other people are puzzled over how Chinese leaders could misread Donald Trump and U.S. administration. But do you think sort of that this resolve is going to last if the economic consequences are going to become bigger? At some point, there must be sort of a limit also for how much the Chinese economy can suffer from this trade war.
And I guess the Chinese don't object too much to this kind of assertive style that the White House has displayed, because China can be pretty assertive at times and bully others easily, as they've done with many countries over the last years. I think what really bothers the leader here, the uncertainty and the kind of unpredictability that comes out of the White House. And that makes, of course, decision making in a system which is pretty much geared towards one man very, very difficult, because he has to argue that he's defending China in the sense of opening up the US market again, obtaining technology rights. So at the same time, he has to communicate that he's going to be more geared towards self-sufficiency. So it's a very, very tight walk for President Xi. Difficult situation for him in a time when the economy is slowing down anyhow because of the debt overhang, because of the problems with the household debt building up. I mean, China has come out of this double-digit growth, entered voluntarily lower single-digit growth, and it has been very conscious about the fact that its economy has to slow, aging, and so forth and so forth. So the trade war unleashed by Trump comes at the most inconvenient time, so to speak. And hence, that makes, of course, decision making very difficult, because the Chinese leadership has promised this population prosperous futures. And now we have a rhetoric everywhere here that is more resemblance to language that was used in the Korea War in the 50s. So it's a very complicated situation for this administration here to get the buy-in from most of the people. And so this will be the first casualty, actually, in many ways, that China has realized not only that they cannot rely on supply chains coming in from outside China, particularly from the US, but also the awareness how vulnerable they are in innovation and in high tech. Because there was a bit of a hubris here as well that China said, we in the West are sinking and the East is rising. And all of a sudden, over a weekend, ZTE can be closed down, Huawei can be threatened, and other companies face similar challenges, banks now with possible. No access to US dollars. So all of a sudden, China realized that actually its real place is definitely not where the US is. And that makes it also difficult how to maneuver in this kind of environment. So I guess the system here is more geared towards damage control, meaning that the economy should not slip further. The economy should not get a psychological impact of uncertainty, which basically keeps investors away, which lowers the prospects of sales in global markets. And of course, it has to think about how they close the technology gap that all of a sudden widens because the US has decided to remain keep vital products out of China. So for them, it has significant implications. I guess, frankly, more than it has implications for the United States. China now has to reach out and will reach out, hopefully, to other countries in order to see how they mitigate this. And they will possibly come across US lobbyists that do exactly the opposite in Europe, in Japan, and other places. So we're in for I guess, long period of time on uncertainty. There might be the occasional trade deal. Xi wants this. Trump likes it. Trump wants to look like the trade deal master, but at the same time, he can easily go into the election year in the U.S. As a trade warrior. He can conclude Canada, Mexico. He can possibly do a quick fix with Japan. A China deal, anyhow, is difficult to sell. And hence, it might well be that we are in this limbo until way into the second term of Donald Trump.
All right, so let's turn to Europe. I think the sort of the question I'd like to ask here to you, Jörg, is where Europe and European businesses find themselves right now in this bilateral trade conflict between China and the US. On the substance, we can broadly see that Europe shares the concerns that the US have listed over China's policies, market access restrictions, behind the border discrimination of foreign firms, favoritism of China state-owned enterprises, and of course, a lot more. We have chosen a different approach in trying to deal with these concerns in China, but I've also heard recently quite a lot of commentary in Europe that is fearing that we're also looking at negative outcomes for Europe if the US actually would manage to settle on an agreement with China. In the first place, now we are getting caught up in this trade war with damaging effects on our exports to China, our sales in China. And then, if and when an agreement is done, it will perhaps give lots of preferences to US firms in China that European firms won't enjoy. So what's your take on this?
Well, as we do this talk, while Wimbledon is on in London, it feels like watching a tennis game. You know, this guy does tariffs, this guy does tariffs. There's a technology constraint and there is a rebuttal. So in a way, it feels like we're spectators and that is a very strange, odd sensation, given that the European Union is actually the largest economy in the world. But we are struggling with the impact. First of all, as European companies on the ground here, of course, we have Chinese customers, lots of them. And of course, these companies export to the US or try to or are not able to anymore. And hence, most of us take a hit because that market is gone and the European market cannot offset it. We haven't seen an avalanche of Chinese products that was destined for the US and cannot be sold there anymore heading for Europe. That was a concern we had, that this kind of overcapacity from China finds its valve in the European market. At the same time, we have seen that the Chinese are trying to accommodate American wishes with baby steps in legislation that helps us as well. Foreign investment law certainly is one of those things that I guess was forwarded a new negative list, the MOFCOM trade and investment catalog and so forth. You see small baby steps in Beijing going in the right direction, but I guess that they don't want to give away too much because they need this in order to, they think, negotiate with the U.S. What we have not seen is, in most areas, possibility of more business for Europe coming out of this. It's very telling that the U.S. has primarily huge problems in agriculture exports, soya bean and other areas of agricultural products come from the U.S., where they really not too much have of an overlap with Europe, whereas in car imports, in chemicals, in electronics, we have not seen any Chinese actions that sort of favors the Europeans or disadvantages the U.S. You rather see a more kind of emotional change in consumer habits where people deliberately say, I don't want to be seen with an iPhone. I buy a Huawei out of solidarity. But this is a very singular case. So in a way, we were actually expecting a bit of a stronger turn towards European suppliers. But China is keeping its low-key approach, which is laudable, and not punishes U.S., say, chemical companies or airplane suppliers and so forth. So in a way, it's not a real benefit that we see. The ironic situation for European business is that actually we gain market share in the U.S. because the U.S. has kept Chinese machinery companies out of the market and central European machinery builders have gained 3% market share. So in a funny way, because of this trade war, you have a positive impact for Europe, but it is confined to exporters from Europe into the U.S. Here in China, we haven't seen much, as a matter of fact. In investment, it's a similar story. You see these mega deals such as BASF with $10 billion in South China. And 4 weeks later, in the same province of Guangdong, you see ExxonMobil with additional $10 billion coming up. So what's the clear messaging is like, we don't favor European companies and we don't, again, put the Americans in the basket. So we yet have to see in a real serious Chinese response. Of course, AmCham is very worried about this. We are in constant touch with AmCham and also to find out where their problems are. And AmCham is sort of like a brother to us because the concerns that you raised over many issues that eventually end up in an AmCham white paper or in the European position paper, which will come out, the new version in September. You know, we add 430 pages of concerns with 800 recommendations. The Americans do the same. We have the same access problems. And that will not go away, of course. So in a way, we sympathize with the AmCham here. We absolutely are unhappy about how this confrontational style from the U.S. has been handled. But we don't feel like a beneficiary at all. The uncertainty of future development is rather concerning. And I guess, again, like in a tennis match, we might be spectators, best case, but the occasional stray ball might hit us at one stage.
There's also a growing debate in Europe now, which you, of course, follows very, very closely, around European positions vis-a-vis China. I think it's fair to say that we, over the last couple of years, have seen not just growing concerns, but sort of a new type of rhetoric coming, both from governments and also from some business quarters. And it seems that many of those voicing their concerns like to see sort of a more harder approach also coming from Europe vis-a-vis China. Some of these harder stances would manifest themselves in policies in Europe rather than policies aiming to open up markets in China. So there has been discussion around whether investment screening in Europe is a way of trying to restrict access to Chinese investors in Europe, whether the growing list of strategic sectors will prevent Chinese firms to acquire especially more strategic firms or strategic technologies in Europe in the future. On the other hand, I'm still not seeing sort of anyone coming up with an alternative proposal for how we're going to try to find ways to open up the Chinese markets in a way that it's moving faster than the gradual movements we're seeing right now. So with a new commission coming in a couple of months, etc., what would be your advice to politicians in Brussels and indeed politicians elsewhere in Europe? What would be sort of an adequate approach to China, not just on our domestic issues, but more on the issues of reaching positive success in opening up the Chinese markets?
You know, the hardening of the European stance, as it looks like now, is, I think, something that we could see coming over the last 4 or 5 years, and it's actually unrelated to the Trump administration. You know, it's one thing to try to invest in China and sell into China and find it difficult to have market access and lose out of business or propositions, and, of course, the technology transfer issue and so forth. But it is a totally different feeling if at the same time China all of a sudden goes shopping in Europe. And the feeling we had here in Beijing is, you know, we have four dishes in the soup, as the Chinese would say, so limited possibility of picking assets, whereas the Chinese find Europe as a very, very sumptuous buffet where they just could choose and pick anything that they liked. And that, of course, I think has caused a resentment. And that was building up over time because on the one hand, of course, European shareholders are more than happy and onerous to sell to Chinese investors, as many companies rightfully are very happy to have Chinese companies buying into them in order to link them up to the Chinese market. And prime example comes from your own country, where Volvo has been rejuvenated by Geely, and you can see so many Volvos here in China all of a sudden. But it is really something that has raised the temperature that this kind of non-reciprocity has caused political concerns. I think in Germany in particular, the GUKA case, where Madia was buying into GUKA at an incredibly inflated price, and Germany felt this is sort of the jewel in the crown of 4.0, and then all of a sudden it belonged to a Chinese company, I think has increased the kind of suspicion is their shopping list. And of course, it was linked to this program Made in China 2025, where China says, then, you know, at that time, 8 years from then, China's going to rule the world in 10 areas, robotics, semiconductors, and so forth. And, you know, if we, meaning China, cannot build this, then we buy it. And so all of a sudden, you felt like you were part of a buffet. And that has, I think, woken up a lot of politicians. 2025, interesting enough, has been totally ditched here. No one talks about it anymore. I think they have realized that it's not just causing the wrong concerns in Europe, but also that it is in itself a planning mega planning problem that China creates for itself. So in a way, this kind of mismatch of opportunities on both sides has started to sour the mood in many ways. And on top of it, you know, if you are a European company and you are trying to go for an M&A as usual somewhere in the world, in particular also in Europe, then of course you feel very strange when a Chinese SOE comes in and you bid for, say, 100. Your competitor, your average American competitor, say, bids for 90, and then the Chinese buys the whole thing for 150. And you look at this and you say, you know, how is that possible? And I mean, the Syngenta deal, the Pirelli deal, and others were very questionable where these SOEs got the money from. And turns out now, after a while, we find out that Pirelli got the deal was subsidized by the China Developing Bank. Now they have to repay it. And the Syngenta deal, the Chinese ambassador to Switzerland said it was a very bad deal because they overpaid. And you know, it is something they shouldn't have done. So in a way, the mood soured because of Chinese grotesque shopping. 150 soccer clubs, for example. Now, it's not that Europeans want to buy soccer clubs in China, but it just shows, you know, the kind of magnitude of money that came in all of a sudden. Then you had Geely buying into Mercedes-Benz, you had Hainan buying into Deutsche Bank. I think now both companies realize that possibly that was not the best deal ever. And that basically sort of raised this thing. And then, of course, the mood in Brussels in particular, and say also Berlin and Paris, soured because, you know, there was constant hacking on major companies. There was this kind of legislation coming out of China that would have challenged the information flow of subsidiaries in China with the headquarters. And, of course, on top of it, more and more it was realized that China's engagement in Europe possibly harms the freedom of speech at universities and academia. So it all came together to a rather unfortunate cocktail that led to an awareness. It's like, hey, guys, this is different. For example, in the investment area, I always advocated as president of the European Chamber, an anti-doping agency in investment, saying that, you know, if we really want to maintain competitiveness in European markets, we welcome Chinese investment, but it has to be fair and square on market mechanisms and not subsidized by someone. So in a way, I guess that led to all the papers that came out. And European Commission has done a reasonably good paper in March. The communique is forward-looking and I think is both structured in a way that the new Commission can build on it. And my advice to European parliamentarians, politicians, decision-makers is as follows. We have to be humble about China. We have really tried hard to move them what we think is more international standards and hardly made a little dent into their mechanisms here. We actually have to realize that maybe China has given us a Sputnik moment where we realize how fast and how assertive they build up their strength. And as we hardly can influence China, the only thing we can sort of do is influence ourselves and fix ourselves. The regulatory environment, the education system, our internet, our cyber market, just in a way try to be competitive with China. And I see this with great joy that the German Industry Association, BDI, came up with a paper along these lines and saying, you know, let's say that China is a competitor in the positive sense of like, let's try to be better than they are. In order to fix our own continent. So in a way, the ironic situation is that possibly we need China in many ways for us to wake up and get out of this comfort zone, you know, get rid of this complacency behavior I see all over Europe in order to maintain the technological edge. So maybe it has a good thing.
Totally agree with that. Internationalism, like charity, begins at home is one of my favorites. Quotations, and I think this is true for Europe's way of dealing with China as well, that a lot of our capacity to compete and be successful in the global economy will depend upon choices that we're going to make in Europe about our own competitiveness. I suppose there is one dimension here when we're talking about what European governments and EU institutions are going to do in the future. This one dimension is about sort of what we can expect from China's own economic reform trajectory in the future. If we're talking about a China that is continuing to open up its economy gradually, but at least moving in the right direction, then of course it's going to be much easier to deal with frictions and concerns we have right now, because we are talking about a development which is at least moving in the right direction. However, if we are thinking about a Chinese economic reform trajectory which is going to be extraordinarily slow, perhaps it's going to be reversed on some issues, and where we won't find any movement on some of the key concerns that we have listed when it comes to competing inside China, as well as having sort of rules on fair competition when China goes abroad and invests and trade with other countries. So what would you say, Jörg, what is a reasonable expectations for China's economic reform trajectory? What should we look for here?
Yeah, I'm a child of the Zhurongji era, where I started being a businessman in China, meaning in the 90s when Prime Minister Zhu was facing an incredible, complicated economic situation, triangular debt, SOEs that were useless, completely non-responsive bureaucracy, and he managed to use WTO session, which took place in 2001, in order to whip its system in shape, an incredible political achievement within an era shortage of time of 5 years only. Looking back, it's just amazing what this man and his administration has achieved. And so we come from this period of time when also the chamber was established and came up with recommendations and works on this kind of ideas of how China can change, because we grew up in a time when China did change, when they found the political guts and when they found the kind of political leadership in order to guide the country to something like it is today. Now, two things happened ever since. First of all, the West imploded in 2008, 2009. The economic model of the West that always was sort of the shining light, and you know that's what China was striving to become, imploded and was ditched as an example of how we want to be here in China. And second, I think it's simple hubris. You know, if you have given the Zhurongji momentum now over the last 16, 17 years, first of all, double-digit growth and then now single-digit growth, after 15, 18 years of growth, you become hostage to your own success. Where do you find a politician in China that is willing to say, guys, we have to really change our system? And everyone will point out, no, look, you know, we have been extremely successful with this kind of controlled economy, SOEs, subsidies, narrowing down the possibilities of foreigners. I mean, what are you talking about? So it's very difficult to find the political guts here in order to say, no, we have to go back to where we have been in 97, 98, and open up and use international pressure in order to move forward. This spirit is gone, unfortunately, and we have to be realistic about it. Looking back, maybe in the mid-90s, end 90s, when there was an Asian financial crisis, 97, 98, that's exactly when Zhu started his reform. We possibly need some sort of headwinds here in order to convince these kind of interest groups to actually move, and the leaders that they should be a little bit more bold in this reform effort. So and we always hope that they don't waste a crisis. But until then, I would say don't expect anything major. Baby steps at best. Interest groups make sure that their turf will not be harmed. In this area of politicization of everything in the times of anti-corruption campaign, there is not much to be expected anyhow. But I wouldn't give up, in particular also as China still is and will remain to be a massive market. We are economic-wise in the 60s in Japan and Korea. There's still 20, 30, 40 years of very strong economic growth in the system, but I see more volatility coming up. So you have to be a bold investor in order to put your neck here and do something about it. But one thing is clear. If China is going to have a crisis unlike 20 years ago, or let alone 40 years ago, it will be felt all over the world. This is something that should worry us. And that's maybe why we keep up the kind of effort in order to remind China to do reforms, because our own economic well-being is at stake. But at the same time, as I said before, we have to be realistic that not much is happening. In the European Chamber, we call it promise fatigue. Lots of nice speeches, little happens, and we have to focus on our own backyard in order to get things done. No, I think, Frederick, the reform spirit is not there. It's a lot of rhetoric. It's a lot of drag and dance. As you can see, there's a little bit of something always happening, but frankly, possibly like in the late 90s, we need a strong economic leadership and a little crisis in order to move this country forward.
Jörg, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for joining our podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.